Well, I'd like to begin by saying thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning, and perhaps thanks goes to Jim, who 2 months ago invited me out for breakfast, and we sat down at Cora's, and he gave me the dates that he was going to be away in May, and we had this little chat about the trip that we had taken together to El Salvador, which I'm about to give you a little snapshot of. And I said to him, May 18th, eh? That's the long gardening weekend. You think anybody will show up? And he laughed, too. Actually, he laughed in the extreme. And, all right, he may not be a gardener, but he's good at a lot of things. I'm delighted to be here, and Helen, I want to thank you for your contribution this morning, your many contributions, and something I've wanted to say to you for a long time is that here at Central, we're very blessed to have you, and to have you sing a solo this morning was terrific. And, you know, I wasn't intimidated about this whole experience of coming here and today until I saw Carl Burden walk in. Suddenly I got nervous because I knew there'd be a professional in the congregation. And I was thinking the only thing that would make me more nervous is having to sing the solo. And my wife Mary knows just how true and what a huge mistake that would be. I also want to say one other thing and acknowledge that my mother-in-law is here. Mary has walked my mother-in-law over from Wyndham Gardens, and she's it's a delight to have you here, Jean. And Jean is a very good Anglican, except today. She's very good United. So we're making her an honorary United Church person for a day, and I'm delighted you're here. Thank you very much, Jean. So this morning, I'm not offering so much a sermon as I am a story. And like all good stories, the fabric of this one is made up of human stories. So I'd like to share one human story and weave this human story into the story of Share Agricultural Foundation and perhaps more particularly the trip that Jim and I took to El Salvador back in February. And this is just one photograph of, and I'm going to take you through a series of photographs with a little bit of a commentary. And this is a photograph of one of the projects that we visited. Our interpreter on your right there, Brian, the son of Les and Marg Frain, who hosted our monitoring trip. But more on that in a moment. The first story I want to tell you is about this gentleman right here. This is Hugh Beatty. Hugh is 95 years old. And yes, he's doing just fine, thank you very much. Some arthritis in the knee, but he's doing well. He's living in the same farmhouse that he was born in Milton, and he's a World War II vet. He landed at Juneau Beach, and this is a picture of him, actually, last June 6th at the Canadian Cemetery, having a little discussion with some of the Canadian young women that were there doing a project and an internship at the Juneau Beach Center. Hugh has become a very good friend of mine, and I want to tell you a little bit about him because his story is woven so tightly in with the story of Cher that I think you might find it interesting. He left his family farm in 1942 to go to Europe, signed up, of course, got married the month before he left. And he left for Europe to fight, not because he had to, because he didn't have to. He was a farm worker, and so he was deemed an essential service. And he didn't have to, but he decided that he would. And to hear him tell the story, he went to war not for king and country or for glory, but for cash. $1.25 a day. And he says that that was at $1.25 more than he was making with his dad on the farm. So, off he went. And he trained on 25-pounders, and he pounded his way through France, Belgium, was present for the liberation of the Netherlands, and he went on to Germany. And after 3.5 years in Europe, he came home to his wife, Melba, and exactly 9 months later, they welcomed their firstborn into the farmhouse. He says, "We got that job done." That's Hugh's humor, you have to know. So you might think Hugh's story couldn't get much more interesting than all of that, as interesting as those years were, settling down as he did into the dairy business, But his story does get interesting, and we're going to visit Hugh. I want you to hold this thought for a moment, and we're going to hear more of his fascinating history, a more recent history, in just a few minutes. But for now, I want to take you to El Salvador. There's Hugh with his 25-pounder. I'm going to take you to El Salvador and begin our trip to El Salvador with this little overview of the organization. Share Agricultural Foundation was born in Brampton on a variety of farmers in the north and west of Brampton about 35 years ago. A couple of them had been on a tour of farms in South America, had seen the need in Brazil, and came back inspired to go back to Central and South America and help people who were less fortunate than themselves. And around this concept, which was inspired by Heifer International, they developed this organization, the foundation of which was a hand up, not a handout, consistent with the concept that you don't give a hungry person a fish, but rather you teach them how to fish. And maybe you give them a fish in the meantime, but you teach them how to fish. And then in addition to a hand up, but not just a handout, was the pass-on principle. If, for instance, a cow was donated to a local farmer in a village or to a village of people, and that cow had babies, and the babies had gave milk, and there was as a result a herd, then some of those cows must be donated to other people somewhere down the road, or at the end of the road, perhaps more precisely, who didn't also have a cow. And I think it's interesting, this was my fourth monitoring trip with Share, and one thing I've learned is that they don't look at those of us that live in Canada and America with a great deal of envy. They're extremely proud people. When I've been to Belize, El Salvador, Honduras, and Brazil, the message I get is quite consistent. They're very happy that we're there to assist them and help them help themselves, but there's a great deal of pride involved. And as far as they're concerned, their definition of wealth is not what we, probably most of us in this church at the moment, would perceive wealth to be. It's got nothing to do with having stuff. In fact, the only stuff they really aspire to having, more than anything perhaps, would be a cow. If you have a cow, you are a wealthy family. Not a wealthy man, but a wealthy family. So, the principle of a hand up, not a handout, the pass-on principle, and then the development of their mission became so strong that CEDA, the Canadian International Development Agency in Ottawa, agreed in the early days to match every dollar that Share raised with three of their own. So these are taxpayers' dollars, of course, that are handed out at the discretion of the federal government in developing countries around the world where they deem that the $3 or the money can be best used. They have a formula. Sometimes it's a matching formula, dollar for dollar, and the most that they give any organization is 3-to-1, and Share has been successful in that regard for some time. They began with dairy cattle. That was the first project that they did in Brazil, and they provide resources to landless people and subsistence farmers who do not have the resources to get started. Landless people and subsistence farmers. These are the poorest of the poor, the forgotten, and to a very large extent, they're a thorn in the side of their government because they don't know what to do with them, who, for the most part, just have nothing. So, on the basis of that, we'll begin our tour. This is kind of a before and after that I want to share with you, and shrouded perhaps in a couple of little trees there that were just bursting into leaf at the time, is a typical home where a family of any number of people might live, and a couple of generations might also live. It's made of mostly tin and cardboard, and also, believe it or not, political signs are coveted because they tend not to break down in the weather. So you see homes sometimes completely shrouded in political signs. Now, this is the before and after. On the left is where a family lives, and on the right is where a family recently moved into, and this is the result of work that the Habitat for Humanity people have been doing. So one of the interesting things about taking a trip like this is that you see where other not-for-profits or NGOs are crisscrossing and working with other NGOs in villages. And by the way, this village was about an hour and a half off an established road up the equivalent of really a dry stream bed. These people live where nobody else wants to live, and that's why they're allowed to live there, because nobody really cares. But that's where they need to find a that's where they need to grow food and produce some kind of food and a living and raise a family and an education. So part of what Share Agricultural Foundation does is a variety of programs that helps people get onto their feet. And in this particular case, we're having a look at a literacy program that's offered to people of any age. All you have to do is show up. That's the only thing you have to do. And so here a young mother is learning how to read, and here middle-aged woman, we'll say, who is actually the mayor's wife, is learning how to read, and they're doing it underneath this canopy, which is a permanent structure. Again, remember, we're up in the middle of nowhere, literally. You could only get there by mule or in a 4x4, and we happen to take the 4x4 option, which I was rather happy about. And this is a relatively new concrete pad with a roof over it, and this is their community center. This is the equivalent of their Crosby Arena, you could say, where, you know, sure, sports activities of some kind might happen here, but this is the gathering place in the local village. And this is where the literacy program was taking place on that day. And there's Craig once again. I called him Bruce. I gave you the wrong name. That's Craig, our interpreter, helping us understand what exactly was going on that day. Now, I mentioned partnerships between NGOs. So SHARE is there primarily with a purpose that revolves around agriculture and helping people feed themselves. But Lions International offer free glasses to anybody that needs them anywhere in the world. And Marg Frein, remember Les and Marg Frein of the Monitors, they go down for 2 months a year. They spend time in a number of Central American countries monitoring and developing plans for SHARE to bring back to Canada, looking for new projects, and they also go back to old projects just to make sure that the money that was sent down there was invested as they said it would be and as they promised it would be, and also to make sure that the pass-on principle is in fact happening. So Marg, God bless her, takes a bag full of glasses with her that she gets from Lions International, and she fits people that need reading glasses. Now, this woman that you're looking at here is 70 years old. I want you to look at the look on her face now. This is with the glasses. She's 70 years old. It's been many, many years since she's been able to look at anything in a close proximity and be able to get it in focus. And she's been in the literacy program. Now, don't ask me exactly how this happens. How do you learn how to read when you're in your 60s and early 70s without glasses, suddenly get glasses and be able to read? But she was, and she stood there and she read from her reader. And through our interpreter, we learned that she was really excited because now she could go into the city hall and sign a piece of paper with her name rather than just an X. And the other thing that she said was that she could now read her Bible, which she hadn't for her whole life. If she wanted to know what was in the Bible, she had to go to church and she had to listen, and that's all she could do was listen. And the other thing she said that I thought was really cool, same woman, was, it's funny, it took 70 years before somebody offered to teach me how to read. And you know, you hear these stories and the stories about the shoes, and you know, you realize we live in a world of need. These are another couple of people, women obviously, who were in the literacy program, and the one on the right has just received her first new pair of glasses in her life. And of course, a free pair of readers, you know, you get them for 14 bucks at Shoppers, and we don't think much about it, but to her, this was like gold. Another program that we support is a jewelry making program, and we have in this photograph some fairly young girls that are learning how to make jewelry, and you might automatically think, Well, that would be fun, isn't it? You know, like a birthday party activity. Only what they're actually doing, and they are having fun, by the way, there's a lot of laughter and a lot of chatter going on at this particular spot. And we're in a different village now, a different day of the week. But what they're actually doing is they're making jewelry that they can take to the local market in San Salvador and sell for cash. Now, you have no idea what cash means to them because they don't have any. They live on what they can produce, and they live in what they can salvage. You noticed that by the first photograph, the house I showed you, right? So to be given the raw material to make jewelry and to be given instruction on how to make a jewelry out of the raw material is a tremendous gift to these people because they don't see the jewelry. They see the opportunity. Another skill that we sponsor through SHARE is that of baking and cooking. Here we have another group of women, very traditional culture, so you won't see men taking bakery classes, and you won't see a lot of women in the masonry and electrician classes, but they exist. And here they are having a great time. They made us these pastries, which I wouldn't recommend to a lot of people, but they were fine. They're just different tastes, that's all. They were having so much fun, and they had been doing this for some time, and if you look carefully, you probably can't see this from where you are, but imprinted on their aprons was the SHARE, there it is there, that's a little easier to see, is the SHARE logo. So, they're thanking us everywhere we go. We get thanks, we get cookies. We get a cup of coffee, we get warm hugs sometimes, and we get tremendous gratitude from people who have been given a hand up. But I want to get back to the roots of the organization, and that is around cattle. Remember, the people who were inspired to do this 35 years ago were dairymen from Ontario. And their idea was that they would go down to Central and South America and give them heifers, or Holsteins rather, and teach them modern methods of milking and farming, etc. The only problem with all of that is that a Canadian cow doesn't do so well in South or Central America. Ticks are a problem, the heat is a bigger problem, and their diet is another huge problem. So they kind of reversed gears after learning an important lesson in the early days, and they started donating Brahmas, which are the local, perfectly acceptable cows. And they're worth the equivalent of about $700. And as I said, that's about as wealthy as most people in this environment would ever dream of being. So they do other things as well. Here I have a photograph of our friend Jim. And what he's doing is he's bringing in the sheaves, you could say. He's smacking a bunch of corn cobs to get the kernels off the cobs through what looks like a hammock. And that's how they did it. So they gave us a little lesson on how to do it, and there's Jim giving us a demonstration. Beneath the hammock, of course, are the corn kernels. And hammocks became a little bit of a theme on our trip, so I took this photograph with my handheld phone, and I sent it to Valerie, Jim's wife, and I captioned it, "This is how Jim does a monitoring trip." I think some of you might have received that, because she had fun sending that out to some of her friends, thinking that we were down in the heat and mosquitoes working our buns off, when, like the actual fact, parts of this were just a tremendous amount of fun, as serious as the mission was. So, stoves. Stoves are another one of SHARE's important projects, and when I first took my first trip, which was 10 years ago, a stove, the raw material for a stove in Central America was $150 Canadian. Today, it's $70. So that we're finding raw material at lower costs. They're made by local people who have the skills themselves. We don't have to teach them how to build a stove. All they lack is the $70 to acquire the cement blocks and a little bit of ceramic and some metal to make a stove. Now, why is this important? It's important because a traditional stove in the Mayan culture does not have a chimney, and so it fills the room with smoke. And the women who do the cooking, number one cause of death, lung disease. So it gets the smoke out of the house. Number two, it uses one-third the fuel. You want to talk about global warming and the denuding of the tropical rainforest? If it uses one-third the fuel, they're cutting down one-third the number of trees that they need in order to fuel these stoves, because they are fired by wood. So, important thing, I think, for us to continue to support. And they do their washing by hand, by the way. And then finally, I want to get to this pumps for food. So, giving all credit to Jim, we were, of course, in constant discussion about what was SHARE doing, what were the benefits, what were the long-term results, how was this helping people get back on their feet so that SHARE, because ultimately our goal is to get out. You don't want to be in a village constantly helping people. You want them to get on their feet so you can leave. And one of the projects that really had a lot of traction, in our view, was the Pumps for Food project. So, for $1,200 Canadian dollars, you can buy a motor, a pump, some plastic pipes, and a big tank, otherwise known, I suppose, as a cistern, in which the water is pumped to. And from the cistern, they bleed water down onto a 2 to 3 acre piece of property that otherwise produces nothing. It produces nothing, and then it produces 3 crops a year. And this is sort of what the system looks like. I want to show you this because the story doesn't really end here. So we're down at a river. They're showing us how the pump works. They're pumping this up into a field on a hill on really marginal land until, of course, you irrigate it. And then all of a sudden, you're able to grow watermelons. So they had this crop of watermelons growing there the second week of February that we were there. And it made such a difference to the village. And once again, it's not just that they're now able to feed themselves, but they're able to take the excess watermelons into the local market and sell them for cash. Cash they can use to perhaps one day buy a cow or whatever, right? Or chickens or goats. And this is a very proud farmer who, and by the way, it's not a farmer that gets access to this pump project. It's a village that would have access to it. So it's a communal thing, and everybody benefits. So you can see by the look on his face, he's pretty happy about this particular pump project. I mention this because before Jim and I left, we made a pledge to Les Frayne and by way of Les to the organization that over the next 2 years we would raise $40,000. Jim and I have decided we would do that because we asked the question, how many pump projects could the Salvadorians actually implement? There's no point in sending pumps to people that don't know how or don't have the land or just can't make the project work. And the answer was 40. We could install 40 projects today, was the answer. And we said, okay, if it's $1,200 a project, we'll go 30. And who knows, maybe we'll be able to finance 40, and we'll do it over the next couple of years. So you're going to hear a little bit more about that as time passes, I'm sure. We have a golf tournament planned for the last week of August, for those of you that enjoy golfing. And we're hoping to launch our Pumps for Food fundraising program at that golf tournament. So now I want to weave back to my good friend Hugh. When Hugh was 58 years old, he heard a radio interview, and by the way, that's him, the tallest of the four guys there, taking a little break during their time in Europe. When Hugh was 58 years old, he heard a radio interview of two farmers from the Brantford area who were launching a new charity, and they were reaching out to the poor of Central and South America. They'd been inspired by another not-for-profit, Heifers International, but they wanted to provide more than just cows. They wanted to reach out to those in greatest need with knowledge, the benefits of modern science, farming methods, and other resources, including animals. So Hugh went home to his bride that night, and he talked for several days about Brazil with Melba. And he said, Melba, let's sell everything and go to Brazil with this new organization. We could do a lot of good sharing of what we know about the business, and we could have a brand new life experience. And Melba finally, after several days of this, said, why don't you put up or stop talking about it? In other words, yes, I'll go. So Hugh and Melba became pioneers for the SHARE organization. They were the first monitors of SHARE projects, and Hugh remained a monitor for 19 years afterwards. They lived in the desert of Brazil for 2 years, 77 and 78. They left Canada for their new home without ever having been to South America, without any knowledge of the language or the culture. This was a dramatic leap of faith. Now, there are many stories about those early days of the organization, and Hugh and Melba and many others walked a new walk, cultivated unbroken ground, sowed the seeds of an organization that would provide a hand up and not a hand out for 35 years, or, roughly speaking, about $35 million in aid and millions more in unpaid volunteer hours by countless numbers of people. Hugh reflects on his experience in Brazil with deep satisfaction and pride. The SHARE organization is what it is today, largely because of the strong start that a small group of concerned Ontario farmers and families had for others in South and Central America. So, my question for Jim over breakfast at Chorus 2 months ago. Jim, why do we do it? Why do we give to others less fortunate? Everywhere. Not just in Central and South America, but in our community here in Unionville, as well as on the other side of the world. And Jim thought about that, and you might be interested in his response. He said, that's what Jesus asks us to do. And thus today's scripture from John, those who love God must love their brothers and sisters also. Those who love God must love their brothers and sisters also. This is Hugh today. And when I asked him the question, why did you commit yourself to go to Brazil and do what you did? And why do you continue to work with SHARE today, even at 95? You could have retired a while ago, as a volunteer, of course. His answer was shaped by his war experience. The greatest lesson of war, according to Hugh, is the realization of the tremendous cost of conflict. When conflict escalates into war, there's nothing to show for it but waste. Waste of money, of land, of resources, of human capital. It was his exposure to enormous waste in 1942 to 45 that convinced him that he had to find a way to do his part to preserve peace. It was his war experience that gave him the courage to put up or shut up, as Melba more accurately put it, to sell everything and bet it all on a game of pitch and toss. Now, Hugh is only part of the story, granted, but his story is woven tightly with that of others who have given and continue to give to the SHARE organization. Hugh explains, I knew war. I saw the waste of it, uses the word a lot. The human capital that wasted, the money, resources, the devastation of it all. I learned one big lesson from my war experience. What we do for others by reaching out and providing help where we can, whether it's at home or abroad, this is the price of peace. And peace is worth the effort. Now, Hugh is a spiritual man. He led funeral services as the chosen lay preacher during the war when there were no clergy in sight. And today, Hugh believes that peace has a price and that it's much less a sacrifice than an alternative to war. And he also believes that the Prince of Peace agrees with him. And the evidence is in the gospel. Well, where am I? I kind of finished that.